So we're getting close to the end of our winter retreat. Done already nearly 2.5 months. And so far, it's been the environment has been very peaceful. And very quiet. It's very nice for practice to have that kind of a situation where you can relax internally, and also you have a lot of space and a lot of time just to observe the citta, the mind-body. So this is, sometimes one can forget how rare it is to have this opportunity. But also as we come near sort of the end, I'm sure many of you have already had the unfortunate kind of change of gear, maybe internally, but what am I going to do next, or changing gear. So the mind gets more active again, maybe thinking about the future. The few times I went to Ajahn Amaro's reading, I always really very much enjoyed the his commentaries and his story that are brought in to teachings which often are, you can read about, you know the concepts such like Nibbana, emptiness, selflessness, and so on. But you don't have often a chance to have a kind of elaboration of these teachings. To be given a wider context, not even just the Theravada tradition, but also other Buddhist traditions. So that kind of helped the mind to grow into a vision that's much more universal. And I was talking today about, with one of the sisters, and another sister joined us, about what do you think I should, what would you like me to talk about today? So they thought I was kind of running out of topics. So they gave me a lot of ideas. But actually, what I was more interested is hearing what they wanted to hear. I mean, what question they had, or if there were any kind of points. So I was not really running out of ideas. It's more, are there anything in particular that... So they gave me, in a way, some ideas. Hence, the book and the paper. I rarely come with books and paper with me, notebooks and notes. And we came eventually to talk about a particular list of the Buddhist teaching, which in a way, I don't know why, it's not that I found the list difficult to find, it's more the terms which were so enlightening for me when I was in Thailand, in the forest, doing my own practice. I discover one of the 16 kilesas, there's a list of 16 kilesas in the Buddhist teaching, and it's called defilements. Trying to find the right word really to hit the, to kind of something to resonate in our kind of Western mind. And defilements, I don't know, it doesn't do much for me, although I can read the definition in English. The pollution, so the pollution of the mind. So for me, it seems to have a more of a sort of more real, something more real. And we were looking then when we talked about these 16 kilesas, we talked about the one that really struck me, and I'll tell you in a minute what it is, but what we were discussing, what came to mind is that for a long, long time we can practice, especially in the forest tradition, when there's not a lot of details and studies and so on, a lot of scriptural studies, you know, getting kind of more a structured and part of the practice, you know. So for a long, long time, especially with somebody like Ajahn Sumedho, you know, no books, no study, don't bother. And so we do traverse an enormous amount of landscapes, inner landscapes, you know, the mind, body, physical elements, and so on. And there's not always a name for it. For example, you know, we hear about greed, hatred, and delusion. That's quite well known. Suffering, the cause, the cessation, and the path leading to the end of suffering. These are terms and concepts that we are familiar with. But it's interesting, though, that as I was in the forest in Thailand, I was reading some books on the teaching of the Buddha, and I came across these 16 kilesa. And one of them, I'd been kind of noticing a particular energy in my meditation, which, and in my daily life as well, integrated perfectly in my daily life, but it was a very unpleasant energy. It's not particularly pleasant. And, you know, I had, because I was very, I'm still energetic, you know, I'm getting old now, but I had a huge amount of energy. And I think it was overwhelming for people sometimes, you know, because of my energy. And I didn't put a name on it. It's just my personality. I'm just like that, you know, that's it. You know, have me like this or just go somewhere else, you know, just this way. But still, it didn't feel right. You know, our sense of self is not something that is particularly balanced. Let's face it, it's a kind of mass of kilesa. It's a mass of delusion, and it's, you know, it's a whole. So, you know, it's also lots of good things in the experience of ego and the self. You know, it's also, there's also kindness, there's also generosity, you know, in the self experience. But it's mostly, you know, you know, the result, the outcome of a mind that's kind of rooted in those kilesa, greed, hatred, and delusion. So the one that I was reading that was particular, you know, struck me. I said, that's what I experience, you know. And it doesn't have quite the same, it hasn't, I don't think I have. I might have the Pali. Okay. It's interesting because I remember a slightly different Pali name. Uh, But this one is called Palasa, and I don't think it was exactly this one, but it kind of corresponds lately, which means, it has a meaning in English. It means domineering, and the other, or presumptions, you know, the kind of presumptuous of presumptions as a word, noun. And the definition in English, I remember, was a kind of more like an overwhelming, you know, overpowering. Yeah. And so that was, I had a name for it. It's interesting because that really resonated, this kind of energy that's more like a yaka energy. Demonic energy. It's not a bad energy. I mean, well, yucca, don't sound like, they don't look like, you know, don't sound that great, you know. If I meet a yucca, I don't particularly want to meet one, but it's more a sense of power, energy of power, strong power, good or bad, I don't know, but. And so that's that was good to have a name for it. Because as with I had a concept and a word, then for some reason, it's like the beginning of the path that makes this experience lose its power. When you don't know what it is, when you, you know, sometimes when you can be aware of it, you can know it, you can see it, you can feel it, you can suffer from it or whatever, have different feelings about it, good, bad, neutral. But you're still quite, I notice when you can name it, even if the name is never quite real, the reality of it, as you name it, it was like, okay, then suddenly you can actually have a handle, you can have a handle on the experience. And so, these 16 kilesa, we have you can find them in modern psychology, you know, in Western psychology, you can find those same concept and ideas. But as I was reading them, I was listening to the commentary of Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is very, I find a wonderful, you know, the way he presents the suttas and the way he looks into the Pali and the knowledge of his Pali is so extraordinary that he can give you, he's a modest, very modest monk, so that's very nice to have a sense of humility from him, and I think he's humble because he knows so much that he's very relaxed, you know, it's like he knows so much that he knows that he doesn't have to be perfect, you know, in his translation. So he knows so much that he knows many translations of one Pali words, you know. And I will just read you the list because you can find them on the internet very easily, but we don't often talk about them. And many, quite a lot of them are actually part of the greed kilesa. Actually, a small number is part of the greed kilesa, in fact, two out of 16. Another nine of them, almost nine, are under the umbrella of anger. Anger. And then a few of them, the rest of them, under the umbrella of ignorance, avidya, like vanity and pride, arrogance. So I'll read them to you. So you got the avidya visama loba, covetousness and unrighteous greed. There was an explanation about righteous greed and unrighteous greed. You have to look for it yourself, this. but it's interesting. And then bhayapada, ill will, koda, anger, upanaha, hostility or malice. You can see it's all under dosa, really, anger. Maka, denigration or detraction, contempt, looking down on people. Maka, that's that. And then six ones is palasa, domineering or presumption. Now, it's the same word in French, and being presumptuous is kind of arrogance, you know, the know-it-all, very confident, and make you feel like as small as a little bit of dust, you know. I think I said that on the phone to my younger sister recently. It came out, I have never used this word, I think, in French, maybe 30 years ago, and it just came out. I said, you know, what I really would like from you is that you don't speak so loud, you know, just not so loud. It sounds a bit presumptuous. And I said, this is funny, I never said this word for, as I say, for 35 years. And she heard it. She's on a spiritual path in a kind of Sufi tradition. So she knew, she's also doing the work on her mind and herself, just like any one of us here. So this is one of the kilesa, just presumptuousness. And you have isa, envy, you know, wanting something that somebody else has. It's, you know, I don't know if I feel envy. Not, I don't feel it very much these days, but it's more like mudita comes more naturally because it's so much happier. In the end, you go for what makes you happy, naturally, spontaneously. You don't have to think about it. It's nice when this kind of response of the heart is established, where you go naturally to the happiness of your heart rather than the falling back into the habit of misery and feeling disheartenedness. Then you have the eighth one is machariya, which is jealousy or avarice or selfishness. Whole program in there, isn't it? To reflect on these different aspects. And then you have the ninth kilesa, upakilesa, is maya, hypocrisy or deceit, being deceitful. And by the way, the upakilesa, I thought upakilesa, for some reason, I don't know, I had interpreted them as superkilesa, because they up. They were up, I suppose. They were superkilesa. And actually, Bhikkhu Bodhi was explaining, they're just more like little alleys of greed, hate, and delusions, you know, the sub-alleys, sub-roads of greed, hate, and delusion. They're smaller. You know, greed, hate, and delusion, the mega kilesa, and these are the upa kilesa, the smaller bits, you know, the little rivulets. And then the tenth one is called satya, fraud. The fruit is on number 10. It's interesting. The number 10 in the commentary given by Bhikkhu Bodhi, it's really interesting. You can see you really have to be very careful. And yes, I might got it wrong, I don't know, tense. Because obstinacy and obduracy. It's under 10 here, I don't know why. What is the 11th? Oh. See, it's interesting, the lists are different. When you look, it's actually different.
The tenth is obstinacy, rigidity, persisting with one's own habits, unwilling to change, to adapt to the wishes of others, and flexibility. That's one of the kilesa. You don't need to know. So it's not so a problem to have it on the 10th, one on 11th. And then the 11th here is it's obstinacy and obduracy, and here it's rivalry, presumptuousness to try to surpass others. That's confusing. Thirteenth is conceit, and 14th is arrogance and haughtiness. Yes, the same. And then the fifteenth one. So I'll just go back to where I was. 10th, so it's fraud. 11th, tambha, is obstinacy, obduracy. 12th is saramba, presumption or rivalry, impetuosity. 13th is mana, conceit. 14th is atimana, arrogance and haughtiness. 15th is mada, vanity or pride. And 16th is pamada, negligence, heedlessness. You know, you remember apamada, pamada, it's in the verses of in the Dhammapada. Yes, heedfulness is a path to the deathless. Heedlessness is a path to death. Yeah, those who never, those who are heedful never die. And those who are heedless are like as if they were already dead. So you've got 16 aspects of the mind, the mind states, which are really worth digging into. I would really encourage you to have a look at those things, not to make you feel miserable, but just because there are aspects of the psyche, of the self, you could say, me, the mind, that is can easily be overlooked. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi was saying in the commentary, you know, these upakilesa are the you know, what takes you into an unhappy future, a miserable future. I think you probably have seen this, otherwise you would not be at Amaravati looking for the way out. Yeah, the unhappy future. And it's not just, it's like an unhappy rebirth. You can see your mind, if you dwell for too long in negativity or in a mind that's kind of depressed or, you know, or jealous or envious for too long, you can see the joy disappears very quickly. The joy of your mind just is gone. And it's not just a future, it's just this, you know, the way the mind creates the next birth and the next birth and the next birth. You know, we're reborn each moment. We're reborn into things. You know, I'm so much aware of that. You know how easy it is to kind of, you know that. Oh well, it's impermanent. You know, oh no, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta. Yes, I know it's all that. You know, it's just suffering and the end of suffering. But sometimes we you know, are we aware of that we have control over the way the mind is rebirthed into, you know? Or are we just, you know, coming from a higher level? In a way, a higher level is when you see, you know, when the mind is seen as, you know, through the lens of the three characteristics of existence, of anicca, dukkha, anatta. You know, you see that's a level which is, in a way, advanced level, in terms of just realizing that good, bad, it's all the same. You know, it's a clinging to that makes that makes the mind very unhappy. But in our conventional life, good and bad do have a play, they have quite an important role, don't they? Because until the mind is able to really capable of, you know, when the letting go practice has been so deeply, profoundly established in the citta, in the mind, in the heart, where you can let, you know, you don't, it just does, nothing sticks, you know, when you know that nothing sticks, then good, bad, it doesn't matter. Because your mind is already established at a level which is a doorway for goodness in all its aspect to manifest. When the mind is at that level, then you are secure. You are established in goodness. You know, when you are at the level where the mind stops grasping, stops clinging, is freer, more spacious, and enable wisdom and compassion and, you know, the qualities, the paramita, you could say, is enabling easily for the paramita to move into your life. You know. So they are very important. At one level, we kind of recognize these things in ourselves. At another level, we don't. We do and then we don't. And in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 7, it's the simile of the cloth. It's a very famous sutta in which the Buddha says that you know, a cloth that's been soiled, even if you dye them, it won't be able to take the dye well. It'll just look really soiled, you know. But if you have a clean cloth, then it will, the dye will take very well. And so he was comparing the cloth to the mind. If the mind is impure and defiled and polluted, you know, then it won't be able to, you could say, to pick up the Dhamma very well. It won't be able to even hear the Dhamma very well. It won't be able to let the Dhamma grow, because we don't see it so well. It's not clear. And that takes us to the place where, what is the clear, what is the cloth that is really clean? When the Buddha compares the mind to this clean cloth, you know. It's a mind that's, in a way, you could say the, you know, I don't, you don't want to have concepts that are not leading to the right direction, but when the mind is free, that's a clean cloth. You know, when the mind is not holding to things, when the mind is not caught up with too many things, when the mind is present in the here and now. And even then, you know, I can see how difficult it is to be quote-unquote clean. Because very often we only hear a very small part of our life. We only see only a small bit because our mind is preoccupied with other things. It's infatuated with other things, and we don't even know it. It's programming and projecting in itself like little projects. We're not aware, but we only hear half of it. How many times does that happen? Have you noticed that? So it doesn't, you know, life doesn't catch on the mind very clearly, because it's confused often, and it's in a state of contradiction or conflict, you know. So I would recommend for you to have a look at the sutta number 7 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the simile of the cloth, and to if you find the very good commentary of Bhikkhu Bodhi on the website, on the web, on the internet, it's really worth it, because the way he presents it, it's has a quite a kind of meditative energy. It's not like wanting to get something, or to. It's a space. It's a kind of meditative space in which you can reflect and feel that the teaching is sinking in at a level that is received, and you can put your king cloth out. You can see there's a space and a peacefulness, So this is one of the things I thought I'll bring, because so the idea is to abandon those kilesa, The most important part is a little paragraph after he describes this upakilesa, in which he described that it's only very short, but it's the way of abandoning those kilesa. So there's different ways of abandoning. You know that it's part of the training of the mind. You can substitute things. So, for example, if you are very angry with somebody, the teaching will tell you you can substitute. From this anger, you can turn it and develop metta. Yeah? If you feel impatient, then you can substitute. You may not be able to let it go, but you can start training the mind with the opposite. So you train the mind with patience. You'll be careful. You remind yourself to be patient. That's one aspect. There are three ways of abandoning. So it's like cultivating the antidotes. You may be very greedy. Maybe you like sweet things, You overdo on sweet things. Not that you're not allowed to have sweet things, but you might overdo. You take more than is good for you. Then you might just cut down a little bit, just reflect on renunciation. From greed, you go to renunciation. That's the antidote to greed, right? So that's, abandoning, called in Pali, we say pahana. We chant this in the Dhammacakka Sutta, don't we? We abandoned. The cause of dukkha. And then the second way of abandoning is I only took the note on the first one. But the second one, you know very well how to do it, by letting go. Letting go. When anger is present, then you learn the skill of letting go. And this is a whole teaching at Amaravati is about that, isn't it? If you read the teaching of Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Chah, they give you masses of tips to enable the letting go to be successful. And I love the teaching of Ajahn Chah, which I think must help some people, because I passed it on to a friend of mine who later on offered me a glass in which you can put a picture, and she had made printed the picture of Lumpur Chah, and his teaching was, if you can't let it go, make it good. That's interesting for me, because when I was watching this, I thought, well, I'm beyond that. Come on, you know. That's good for her, but I think I'm beyond that, you know. I can let it go. But actually, very often, it has to do with the first one. You know, if you may be able to let it go moment by moment, you know, but still hasn't gone completely. It's a bit like the overpowering energy that I was feeling. For a long time, I saw it, I feel it, experience it. And because of putting my attention onto this, I was able to recognize it when I read it. When I read the words, I recognized it. Maybe if I hadn't had paid attention, if I hadn't been mindful of it for a long, long time, this word wouldn't have meant nothing to me. Do you understand? So don't think you ever waste your time, even when nothing is happening. You, in a way, you are it's like a preparation of the mind ground for seeing things that it might not be able to see without that long preparation, long kind of cultivation of patience and endurance and, you know, and just be sort of bearing with the unsatisfactoriness of your project, you know, and so seeing no success at all, you know, feeling more miserable and so on. And then at some point you can see, you know, maybe later on, you're surprised, you say one word and like it's like an illumination. This word, you've read it millions of times, you know, but because your mind was ready, you suddenly saw it in a different way. You see? During my retreat, I'm very fond of a Vedanta teacher who's passed away now. I like him because he's completely no-nonsense. I like people who are no-nonsense, in a way. And by this, I mean they're really understating stuff, you know, they no pretense, nothing. And they, you know, supposed to be, I mean, his life is quite extraordinary, and he was, without going into details, because I might kind of, how can I say it, take you off the Buddhist path. But it's a lovely story. Anyway, he got a completely kind of illumination at the age of 13, American, and to cut a long story short, he had a very deep connection with Ramana Maharshi. He saw Ramana Maharshi at the end of his bed for the first 7 years of his life as an apparition, and then recognized eventually that it was Ramana Maharshi. He did not know it was him. And so through the help of teachers and so on, he went to Ramana Maharshi and he stayed with him for about 3 years until he passed away. But basically, he was obviously quite enlightened. He was not a Buddha, but he was quite enlightened. And all the tips that he gives to his students, one of his students once said to him, do you practice this? You know, his name is Robert. You practice this, Robert? He said, no. He said, why do you ask us to do these things? And basically, one of the teaching he was giving to them, he's got three things, but I don't need to give you all three, but one, it was just realize you do not exist. You do not exist. So I've read these books, you know, for years. But then, during the retreat, it's interesting, it had a completely different resonance for me when I read it. I took it as a skillful means. My mind doesn't... I know, in a way, I've had the insight that this mind is not mine. But still, even though it's not mine, it still has... things come to this mind, you know what I mean? It's not finished. It's got lots of karma left. But what I noticed is if we don't question this mind, then it's very easy to fall back into the old habits. And so what I began to do as a kind of skillful means, I just said to myself, this mind does not exist, quite consciously. And the thing that interested me when I did it, which never happened before, it's almost like Mara just fled. You know, like, you say, I know you, Mara. And when I said, this mind does not exist, it was completely empty, but in a way that was, there was really nothing there, you know, nothing. It really did not exist. And you know, John Amaro yesterday in his presentation said, you don't exist and you do not exist. You know, we all know that when the mind is completely let go and just kind of, you know, like he demonstrated yesterday, you know, the mind just is not there. I mean, it's body, brain, you know, blood. But it's empty. But this skillful means was very interesting, how it wasn't just empty. It's like, you felt like it had been emptied out of all the stuff that just kind of keep coming, you know, all the time in consciousness, you know. So it was very interesting because it's not something is finished once you do it, you know. Your mind is an accumulator. It accumulates memories, it accumulates stuff. It accumulates energy, you energy, everybody else energy. It can accumulate easily, pile up stuff, and then suddenly it does not exist. That seems so real. Real, not surreal. It seems so the truth. It does not exist. And so, to me, it's a very peaceful realization. I feel very comfortable with a mind that does not exist, personally, because I know that this mind is much more, in a way, capable when it's filled up with stuff. So, you have to find your own way, in a way, to keep letting go. So, you know, to change the, you know, to use the opposite of a mental state to help to see it and let it go, and then to let go of these kilesa, and then the second, I don't have it, you know, according to what Bhikkhu said, but for my own experience, you can also let go by seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta, seeing that the mind, you know, things go. I mean, they don't wait for you, they just go. The only thing that keeps them with you is that you just identify with them. I mean, they're just part of your life, you know. If you have neighbors you really like, why would you throw them out, you know? So that's a kind of thing. We just like to have certain things around us. And sometimes we like to have miserable things around us, which is really kind of funny, isn't it? How much we like to hang out with our most kind of depressed mind and miserable mind. Very funny. Not that we like it, but you just hang in there. And you realize if I said, at the right moment, with the right time, and the right years behind me, it does not exist, you know? Yeah. It only exists because it's not challenged. That's the thing. It's not challenged, it's not questioned. So it's really good to challenge, because what Ajahn Amaro was saying yesterday, I almost said it, but I refrained, you know. I said, well, some people, you know, made a profession out of what you say, Ajahn Amaro. Is that true? If you know anybody knows Byron Katie, yeah? Anybody knows Byron Katie here? Or are you too young for that? Well, she was enlightened. Another one that Achin Sumedho, once somebody was trying to hassle him to find out what was Byron Katie so special about her. And basically, I think he wanted to go to her. He said, well, one of those Buddha, silent Buddha, you know, Pali word? Pachaka Buddha, that's right. So that's what he said about Baron Katie. And she was depressed for about 10 years. Just in case you're depressed, don't worry about it too much, you know. And then at the end of 10 years, she got and then completely, you know, she released from all delusion. I say that to people who are depressed, you know, to give them some good hope, you know. And she spent a whole, I mean, after that, that was how she helped people, is that challenging them. What the Janama was saying, you know, is that so? Is that so? Is that so? Really? Is that so? So that's what Baron Katie's technique has been. You know, she's written books and she's earned her living also with that and helped thousands of people. Tens of thousands, maybe millions of people. But that's just had a question. She didn't have a path. I mean, I don't know what path she had, you know, but that was her path, it seemed. So to challenge the mind, it's really important. Don't ever sleep with your mind for too long. It's really dangerous to let the mind kind of without support. So we're getting close to the end. I've got the abandoning bit. Oh, I'm so happy with that, because really, it would be such a shame to talk about all this klesa and have not the way out of them. So I'm finishing with that. Abandoning the second way is, well, it's very important, because we don't talk much about this here. You know, suppression is like, no, you know, let it all out, you know. So suppression is what you do when you go into the concentration. You know, that's, I'm not going to read all of it, you know, but because when you are going to the jhanas, you know, going to deeper concentration, then, you know, without even going to the jhanas, the concentration, you notice it feels good, you know, you're in a bubble, it's quite nice, but there's nothing happening there. Without, it's not even absorption or anything like that. It's just concentrating, the tendency to want to suppress. And it's not, you know, we have, I mean, I've heard a lot of negativity about these things, you know, a lot of judgment. And if you don't have a good teacher, you can get easily, you know, addicted basically to the peace of a mind, one-pointed, you know, one-pointed mind. But, you know, if you have a good guidance around you, you know, you that one-pointedness that you cultivate, you know, can be easily, I'm not talking about jhanas necessarily, but just a one-pointed ability to stay with one thing at a time, that calms the mind as well, and it brings a sense of quiet, you know. The mind is just on one object. Because in vipassana, the mind is on many objects. You see, you're looking at many things. In Thailand, they consider the vipassana quite tiring for the mind, because it's much more. And I'm going to shock you, but I'm going to also to quote Ajahn Lee Dhammadharu on that, so I've got my backup with it. Ajahn Lee Dhammadharu said that actually vipassana is much more refined than jhanas. I've tried to find this teaching, and I haven't found it again yet, but I said, why does he say that? He said, because in the jhana, you focus on one object, and you are one with it. So the mind is not terribly kind of subtle, you just like block, you know, on one object. But with vipassana, you have many things that you observe, and wisdom is there to see what's happening. It calls it more refined, and I hope I quote him well. Refined mind is this, you know, the mind that can see anicca, dukkha, anatta, that can see the mind, the stillness of the mind that observe the objects, the, you know, the satipatthana objects that we have in the sutta. So he described it as being more refined than the jhanas. It's an interesting thing. So that's a second way of abandoning. Third way, eradication of defilement. So that's more like the deeper. That's what we practice here in a way. It's the when you really want to go to the root of your defilements. You know, you really want to release, to uproot, to, you know, the whole thing together when you're on the path to Nibbana, in a way, to full liberation. So that comes about, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, well, he says, you know, to the point where it can't ever arise again, you know. So 16 defilement, how do you come to the point where never arise again? So from this point of view, you know, that can only happen if you are a stream entry or a once returner or a non-returner or an arahant, when they uprooted completely. So certain kilesas are uprooted completely at certain level, like the kind of stream entry, the sotapanna, and then you have once returner, you have other kilesa, and then a non-returner, then ill will, anger, hostility, and heedlessness, and all that sensuality, and are eliminated at the level of the non-returner. And the level of arahantship, you eliminate all the other defilement that hadn't been eradicated before that. So, as I say, don't trust what I've written. You know, I mean, don't, you know, sort of, I took those notes very quickly. I would encourage you just to listen to the commentary of Bhikkhu Bodhi and to let it sink in a little bit, you know. Not to judge it. You don't need to judge it or to think, oh, it's right, wrong, blah, blah. It's really good information for the mind to get some right directions. So I'm glad that I left you the three way of abandoning this. And the last way was the, you know, I mean, with the Ajahn Chah tradition and Ajahn Sumedho tradition, you start uprooting them, you know, straight away. But between uprooting each moment, you uproot something, you know, by just letting them go, letting them die, letting them pass away, stopping the identification or realizing that it's not you, not yours. You know, even say that to yourself, it's not me, not mine, not you. The Buddha does that in his teaching. So, you know, when I was quoting the Robert Adams, you know, skillful means like, I do not exist, my mind does not exist, you know. It's a similar kind of message, not me, not mine, it's not mine. And just by doing these simple things, it has an influence on the mind. You give him a language of Dhamma. Normally, the brain or the habits, you know, they kind of survive with, you know, on the language of delusion, avijja. It's me, mine. Don't step on my feet. It's mine. You know, you get angry because somebody takes away something from you, or you're frightened. That's a language. That's a vocabulary of delusion. So to be able to rephrase things, you know, to help the mind to come out of the habit of delusion is skillful, very skillful. You know. If you think about the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which is the first sutta that the nuns learned at Chittas, I remember we spent a whole Vasa studying the suttas. That was one way Ajahn Sumedho thought we could get on all together, at least once a day, to learn chanting We managed to learn it by heart by the end of the Vasa. I think it must have been 1980 or something. So it was a long time ago. And we did manage to chant it all together, you know, without fighting or without, in tune. And that was a great harmonizing, skillful means, actually. I can see, you know, if you don't get on with somebody, do some chanting with them. It's quite nice. You get all your kind of defiled mental states kind of suppressed for a little while. Okay, well, I wish you a good few weeks now. And talk to your mind, because really it's probably already out of the door for some of you. Yeah? Probably gone down to another country for some of you. Or at least to your home, your cozy home in England somewhere where your pet is waiting for you, for the group, the lay group. We don't have pets here. But certainly some of you might think, oh, May, what's going to happen in May at Chinsomedo, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Well, I don't suffer from that, I have to say myself. I've seen enough of May in my life to be rather blasé about it. And feel, oh yeah, one other one, you know, another meeting, lots of monks, lots of people, lots of, you know, a few nuns. But again, instead of letting the mind go, you know, go back to memory you had, which are not so positive or not so kind of joyful or anything like that. You can just be either neutral, just let it go and don't make anything of it. Or even bring some, bring the opposite, you know, like remember the goodness of Lumpur Sumedo, remember the goodness of the monks and the nuns practicing Dhamma and all the lay friends like you practicing Dhamma. You know, the mind is so easily goes into kind of pathetic programs, you know. Negativity, critical program is so easy. It just jump into it with its 2 feet and wallow in it and swim into dukkha. So I tell you, I know this because I'm talking about my mind as well, you know, so I know it very well. Okay.